dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have come to know and greatly admire over a number of years now our guest for this full hour. He is Douglas Murray, an extraordinarily thoughtful, articulate, and well, especially courageous individual who has written 5 best-selling books about some of the most controversial topics of our time, and done so with clarity and articulateness, of course, but verve as well. And we're to speak with him on this particular occasion about his most recent book, newly published at that, that is entitled The Madness of Crowds: Gender, Race, and Identity. I am thrilled to have this associate editor of The Spectator in the United Kingdom and a fellow at the National Review Institute with us to drill down in some detail on the sort of cultural warfare that is taking place, in his country, the United Kingdom, and ours, and what its real purpose is, which I am afraid is to silence people like, well, Douglas Murray and a number of the rest of us. It's so good to have you back, Douglas. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Frank.
So if you would set up this conversation about the madness of crowds by explaining the title and describing the phenomenon and its impetuses.
Well, it follows on from my last book, The Strange Death of Europe, which was on the migration, immigration issue and Islam in Europe in particular, which was centered around the 2015 migration crisis. And The Strange Death of Europe was my attempt to do an expose of one of the most painful and difficult subjects of our time, which you well know is a very, very perilous bit of terrain, but nevertheless, one which people who have a voice and have a platform, I think, have to talk about and think about and speak about and write about. And I was delighted that The Strange Death of Europe had a terrific reception in many, many countries. And what I realized was, of course, that something I had intuited for some years, but had become worse and worse without, I think, some of us knowing it, which was that all the most important issues, indeed, the seminal issues of our time, we had proved to be almost completely incapable of having a conversation about and arriving at reasonable and indeed rational policies or conclusions. And in the aftermath of doing The Strange Death of Europe, I became increasingly aware that in countries like my own, the United Kingdom, and in America, which I spent a lot of time in recent years, and various other Western democracies like Australia and New Zealand, there was a similar pattern that was emerging, particularly among the young, by which I mean basically millennials and after, which was that there were a specific set of issues that they were forcing into politics, into the culture, in many other ways, without any respite, and in particular with, I thought, very little consideration. And the biggest sign was that any time any adult, for want of a better term, ventured into any of this terrain, their careers were terminated. They were over. I'm thinking of cases like Professor Tim Hunt, a Nobel Prize winning scientist, who is, you know, Nobel Prize in science should mean something, but he made a joke in South Korea at a conference about men and women falling in love in the lab. A woman in the audience complained on Twitter that this was sexist, and by the time Professor Tim Hunt landed back in the UK, he'd been fired from every position he had. Now, What I realized was that although there are other madnesses of our time, I mean, I think you can put quite a lot of the green agenda into it. Nevertheless, pretty much all of the crowd stampedes and the thoughtlessness and the attempt to career destroy and the attempt to not think things through centered around four issues in particular. And I do them chapter by chapter in The Madness of Crowds. And I do them in order there. I do, first of all, gay. What it means, what we know about it, what we don't know about it. Secondly, women, in particular, relations between the sexes. Thirdly, race. And fourthly, trans. And that last one being one of the most recent and bitterly fought culture wars of our time. And so I just decided that it was time that somebody addressed all of these issues in as reasonable and I hope humane and careful a way as possible, but also said the things that we're all thinking and worrying about. Because here's the thing, if I may say so, there was a time when you could pretend that these things that unite these issues, that's called at various times identity politics, intersectionality, and many, many ugly terms, there was a time when you could pretend that this was limited to, you know, liberal arts colleges on the West Coast of America. But you can't pretend that anymore because the privilege conversation, the whole woke agenda is now something which is in every government in the West. It's in government departments. It's in local government. It's in corporations. It's in the workplace. It's people being chosen and selected for jobs, not because of their competency, but because of their characteristics. And so I thought it was time somebody actually just exposed this, opened it out and said, what are we doing?
This is so daunting a proposition, and I want to sort of tease out some of the specific insights that you have provided us in the new book, The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, Douglas Murray. But before we get to that, just again, to stay with the overview, what you basically have touched on here is, as I think you called it, the sort of woke agenda. This is a term that I think many of us may not know what you're talking about, but what do you mean by that? And who is it that is advancing this so-called woke agenda in your country and ours and elsewhere?
Yes, I say it should be taken incredibly seriously and should be understood on its own terms as effectively a way to impose a new metaphysical system on the West. That is, that in the wake of religion's retreat, in the wake of the retreat of many political ideologies, we find ourselves in this position of being listless and without purpose. I'm not speaking, of course, myself or for you, many of your listeners, but as societies, we lack an overarching narrative. And into that vacuum, particularly young people, and with some good cause, I have to say, are identifying purpose in life as coming from advocating for more and more sectional minority rights, see life's purpose as coming through waging cultural battles around these issues, weaponizing them, and indeed politicizing every aspect of their identity and their lives.
Well, this brings us to the who's behind it, and that's going to be where we start off on the other side of this very short break. Much more with Douglas Murray, the author of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
It is a delight to say we are joined for this full hour by Douglas Murray. We've been discussing his new book, The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. He has set the stage for a specific two-example discussion of how this intersectional war, as he calls it, is being waged against, well, Western civilization, it seems to me, Christendom, if you will, Judeo-Christendom, the tenets and traditions and values and institutions of this republic of ours, as well as his own native land, the United Kingdom. Douglas, you set the stage brilliantly for two specific examples that illuminate the thrust of your new book on the madness of crowds. Go ahead.
That's right. Well, one of the things that struck me so much in recent years, and I'm sure it has a lot of your listeners, has been, why does the situation in our countries on rights issues get portrayed as if it's never been worse at the stage at which it's never been better? I mean, you know, I happen to be gay myself, and the gay rights movement, broadly speaking, arrived at a terminus in the last couple of decades. There's no particular more rights to argue for. Once you're at equal, once you have equal rights, what more is there to do? Well, of course, all rights movements know that there's something that happens that the charity world also knows, which is set up a charity to cure a disease, and if you cure the disease, the charity will find a way to continue. Because people's jobs will be at stake, people's pensions will be at stake. And I've been struck in recent years that in the remnant of the gay rights movement, there are people who keep trying to push and find new wars to wage. It's what I describe, citing the late Australian political philosopher Ken Minogue, as St. George in retirement syndrome. You know, St. George slays the dragon and gets so acclaimed for it that he may stagger around the land looking for smaller and smaller beasts to slay, and more dragons, until eventually he might be found swinging his sword at thin air. Now, the thing that struck me, as I say, though, is that the LGBT part of that, just for one, never mind for the moment, the issue of women's rights and racial equality, has been weaponized to a quite extraordinary degree. And two examples of this have been on my mind recently, and I mention in the book. And this puts us onto the subject of what is actually going on here. The two of the so-called squad in America, who you're very familiar with, Frank, Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, these are not, of course, in any normal way particularly prominent. They're congresswomen, but you obviously get a huge amount of airtime, huge amount of attention. But here's something that's fascinating. In her first weeks in Congress, AOC did a fundraiser for a British charity called Mermaids that is highly controversial in the UK and which advocates the giving of hormone blockers to children if they are identifying as gender dysphoric. That is, they think that they are of the opposite sex and they'd like to postpone puberty in order to then have operations when they're of age at 18 in the UK. Now, this is an incredibly sensitive and controversial thing. But what business is it of AOC's to be raising money for a puberty blocker drug charity in the UK? Let me give you a second example. Ilhan Omar, again, her first months in Congress, to all intents and purposes, we know that Ilhan Omar is many things. But why would she have spent even a nanosecond, as she did, writing to the head of one of the sports authorities in her district, berating him for not allowing a male-to-female transsexual to be allowed to win the women's weightlifting competition locally? Now, I think this is absolutely fascinating because, as I say, people have been very slow to pick up on some of this. But there is no reason why Ilhan Omar, who, you know, seems to be a relatively devout, perhaps very devout Muslim, among other things, should make any kind of priority of making sure that the male-to-female transsexual wins the women's weightlifting competition. What is it that's actually going on in these cases? I think that it is demonstrably the use of, on this occasion, trans, but the same thing has been done with gay, the same thing has been done with racial issues, the same thing has been done with women, using trans as a battering ram for something else, specifically to attack, derange, and demoralize the mainstream in America, to say, you know what, sex doesn't exist, men and women don't exist, and if you think they do, we're going to call you a phobe and a bigot and much more. And it is so striking at this stage that you can predict with, as I say, 100% certainty who wants the man to win the women's weightlifting and who says, Hang on a minute.
It does come down, though, in this case, and I think you've powerfully, you know, elucidated the syndrome here. Douglas Murray, it does come down to, at the end of the day, a weaponization, if you will, of the agenda against one of the putative minorities in question. As you point out, it's not really a minority, women, but feminists certainly are a minority, and they are being, you know, thrown under the proverbial bus by this trans agenda. And I just wanted to ask you, again, as a gay man, you've, I think, really captured an important insight here. It does seem to this straight man that the gay agenda has really run its course. All rights have been established, it seems. I'm sure there are examples of continued bigotry, but in the formal sense, what's left to do? And it seems on that basis that the sort of gay advocacy enterprise has thrown itself into elevating this transgender agenda with the kind of zeal that is just, frankly, peculiar to me, especially since it does seem to be athwart some of the other perceived, you know, members of this intersectional coalition. So how does that work? And what is you used a term that's very powerful and very, I think, accurate, deranging the society with these pronouns and with these, whatever the number is, 26, 85, 39 different genders. You know, I mean, heaven's sakes, talk to us about that.
I expose why this is so deranging in The Madness of Crowds. And there's one thing in particular. I show that there's an analogy I use, which is hardware versus software. Most rights movements start to win when they demonstrate or argue that the issue in question is a hardware issue, not a software issue. That is not an issue of choice. Now, one of the reasons why we are in America and other democracies going through a derangement on this is because the radical left intersectional view is trying to invite us to believe things that are absolutely impossible to believe simultaneously. And here is the biggest one. They are asking us to simultaneously believe that being trans is a hardware issue. That is, you are born trans, there's nothing anyone can do about it, and you should just make sure that society catches up and make sure they put you in the opposite body as soon as possible. Now, that's proposition one. Proposition two, also being simultaneously pushed by the radical left intersectionalists, is being a woman is a software issue. It is something you choose. It is, to quote Judith Butler of Berkeley, one of the most prominent theorists on this in recent decades, it's an issue of performativity. Now, you could believe one of these things. I think both are untrue. But you could believe one of these things, but you cannot simultaneously believe both. You cannot believe that women choose to be women, but trans women don't choose to be trans women. So what I have tried to do in this, as in every other area, is the following. I've tried to say and think through the things that we have all been too terrified to think through, and I show why it is not true on its own terms, never mind anyone else's, and then say, so why are you trying to destroy society and show America to be uniquely bigoted and appalling and needing to be pulled apart? Why would you be doing that when your own claims are demonstrably untrue?
Well, and I think the answer, and I take it this is your answer as well, is it is a revolutionary construct. It is about tearing down America and replacing it with something else. And we're going to turn in our last segment with you to your previous book on the strange death of Europe to discuss this a bit further. But it does seem as though if intersectionality is an odd thing, not least odd about it is this merging of what we call the red-green axis, the radical left on the one hand, the Marxists, the communists, the you know, anarchists, the Antifas, all of them, and the green of the Sharia supremacists, the Islamists. And that unholy alliance, it seems to me, Douglas Murray, has a lot to do with the power that has actually amassed behind this sort of revolutionary program. If it were one or the other, but not both, it might be a more manageable proposition. Your reaction to that?
That's right. I think that one of the extraordinary things in this era is the merging of completely antithetical agendas, so long as they have the same opponent.
Yeah, they'll turn on one another in due course, inevitably. But for the short term, the enemy of my enemy is my friend seems to be operating, doesn't it?
That's right. Well, I mean, there have been extraordinary examples of this in recent years. One is that you can actually, for instance, occasionally hear supporters of the Islamic Revolutionary Republic in Iran stressing how forward-looking Iran is in regards to transgender rights. It is absolutely laughable, but here is the lie that they don't tell anyone, which is that it is true that the Ayatollah Khomeini issued rulings about people changing sex, and as a result, Iran has had a certain amount of sex changes and is comparatively forward-looking, if you want to use that term, in the region. But there is a reason, which, of course, the supporters of the Iranian theocracy do not say, which is that if you are found to be gay in Iran, you will be hanged from a crane or otherwise executed. And so people are offered life-altering surgery instead of being hanged. And this is presented as progressive.
Yeah, life-altering versus life-ending. Much more with the marvelous Douglas Murray right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with one of the most extraordinary men I know. His name is Douglas Murray. He is the author of numerous books, all of which have as sort of their sort of common denominator that they have tackled with great integrity and courage some of the most controversial topics of our time. That is certainly true of his newest book, just out. It is entitled The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. And Douglas, you've nicely set this up, introducing certain terms and realities in our time, notably this woke agenda idea. But I do want to tease out whence comes this effort to force particularly younger people, but the society writ large, to conform to certain standards with respect to, identity and culture that are absolutely antithetical to the kind of diversity, certainly diversity of thought, that is often claimed by the perps, the perpetrators here. Is it fair to say that what we're really looking at is sort of the cumulative effects of the march through the institutions that the cultural Marxists, the hard left, the Frankfurt School and its successors and followers have perpetrated over decades now, coming to kind of the logical and horrific destination that they had in mind for us, namely a sort of totalitarianism that is, again, antithetical to what we hold dear as free people.
Well, that's right. I take these issues, as I said, one by one, gay, women, race, and trans. But in between each chapter, I have a what I call an interlude segment on some of the deeper things that are going on underneath. And the first of those is on what I describe as the Marxist substructure, because you can't escape the fact that much of this new agenda has deeply Marxist substrates. I'm thinking of things like the basic interpretation of life as primarily being about power, a pyramid of power with capital and capitalism at the top. You know, the famous Marxist interpretation, indeed the Marxist posters of a century and more ago, were portrayed the existence of our societies as being a pyramid at the top of which was capital and beneath which were layers of society, all held up by the noble shoulders of the working class, who were oppressed and held down by all of the others. And it's very striking that the current intersectional identity politics view of life has exactly the same structure, just with different people at the lower rungs. There are actually Marxist scholars I quote in the book, and by no means unsighted or fringe figures, major figures, who were saying in the early 80s and at other other times, you know, that the working class have basically let us down. They didn't provide the revolution, but we need to find the revolutionary forces, and we can find them within minority groups, racial minorities, sexual minorities, and, although they're not a minority, of course, women. And this was completely explicit. And although, I say in the book that there are several things one has to understand about this. The first is that some people, particularly young people, do not understand that substructure. They don't understand where this comes from. And they have been simply misled and are being misled into leading what I think are futile lives based on fighting this intersectional war to the death. And I think that it's a terrible way to spend a life. But there are other segments of this that are explicitly political and which are absolutely plainly using identity characteristics of people as a battering ram to do something else. What is the something else? I think you get glimpses of it. Let me give you a couple of examples. When Peter Thiel, a Silicon Valley tech billionaire, comes out in support of Donald Trump at the 2016 Republican convention, he says on stage, "I'm proud to be gay, I'm proud to be an American, I'm proud to be a Republican, I'm proud to be supporting the Republican nominee for president." The main gay magazine in America, Advocate, immediately runs a piece saying, "Peter Thiel may sleep with men, but in no way is he gay." When Kanye West comes out in support of Donald Trump a year or so later, the main liberal magazine in America, The Atlantic, a magazine with an amazing history, runs a piece by Ta-Nehisi Coates, the most celebrated writer of his generation. And Ta-Nehisi Coates says, basically, Kanye West is no longer black. And, of course, we see the phenomena of feminists like Germaine Greer, who refused to do the trans issue correctly, as it's portrayed, have been described by feminists as no longer feminists. And one of the things I say is, if Peter Thiel isn't gay and Kanye West isn't black and Germaine Greer isn't a feminist, something else is going on here. This is brute politics trying to hide itself behind identity traits.
Right. One of the features of this, and I would like you to define intersectionality, because I must say I keep being told that's what we're all about now, but I don't really know what it means. And then, you know, just we'll again explore in a little bit more detail what the immediate purpose of this intersectional war is. But define that term, if you would, Douglas Murray.
Intersectionality is an idea that was brewed, you'll be unsurprised to hear, of course, in various left-wing campuses in America. It was happening from the 1970s, and it's basically an ideology based on the presumption that we live in a patriarchal, white supremacist, cis heteronormative society, and that it oppresses this society, oppresses minority groups, including women. And it argues that we all have intersecting aspects of ourselves and our identities, as other people do, and that if you unlock one part of systemic bigotry, say transphobia, then it's not enough just to unlock transphobia. You've got to unlock the others too, because all of these oppressions interlock. This was just a game, really, that was being played on, I'd say, liberal arts campuses in the US. And when I started looking into this some years ago, I assumed that there was some serious scholarship at the root of it. And I was amazed that there's almost nothing of significance. One of the main intersectional texts from the 1980s from a professor at Wellesley College is basically just a few pages of assertions about how racist and appalling America is. It's a list of assertions. It's not an academic work. But what I try to show is, first of all, that in the wake, I believe that in the wake of the financial crash of 2008, this flooded into our system. Why? I think for many reasons, one of which is that the adults in the room lost confidence because they had been shown to have very nearly crashed everything. And as a result, something happened which we know from history, but we've been unwilling to recognize in the present, which is that when the economics goes bad, other things happen. You become very vulnerable as a society to bad ideas. And in the last 10 years, this understanding that a society works according to these intersectional lines, has ridden through the American culture, has ridden through the Western culture with unbelievable ease. And then you can demonstrate this, as I do, from just internet searches, for instance, in the last 5 years becomes highly weaponized. And this, I think, is what is going on. Most parents of students at colleges now in the US will recognize some of this. And as I say, increasingly, people in the workplace recognize this because everything has become about the identity of the person and not, contra Martin Luther King, the content of their character.
This is so elegantly said. So intersectionality, then put in layman's terms, sounds to me to be basically a vehicle for trying to cobble together, well, critical mass, I guess, in terms of a revolutionary, you know, cadre. It's the people who are all about how oppressed blacks are, or the people who are concerned with oppressed homosexuals and so on. It's coming together because of this intersectional thing to try to overcome, not racism as it's or the antipathy to that particular minority, whatever term is used for it, but to overthrow basically the pyramid. So it is a revolutionary moment and movement. And I think you are so right, of course, Douglas, that particularly on the campus, but in academia, as well as the culture, as well as Hollywood, as well as increasingly corporations and government, we're witnessing this revolutionary fervor translating into power, and power most especially to silence those who are not with the program.
That's right. And I think, as I say, that there are glimpses of this that make this completely explicit. You're right to say that the aim is primarily revolutionary. I demonstrate, by the way, that it can't work on its own terms even, for reasons I'm very explicit about in the book. For instance, the claim is wrong demonstrably from the outset. For instance, these minority rights campaigns actually run consistently against each other. They don't interlock together. They grind against each other. Most obvious one is being that trans rights are very fundamentally opposed to gay rights. Trans rights are fundamentally opposed to women's rights. And I show why in the book. But here's the thing that's most fascinating. Why is it that at this stage you can predict with 100% accuracy who is going to pick up the latest claim and weaponize it? Let me give you two very quick examples.
I'm going to ask you to hold on because I want to get to those two examples and do justice to them, and we won't before the break. So let me just pause to reintroduce our guest. He is Douglas Murray. We're talking most immediately about his brand new book, The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. But we're exploring some of the themes of others, including one we'll turn to in our last block, The Strange Death of Europe. But in the meantime, we'll get into these two examples on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are visiting with an associate editor of the highly acclaimed Spectator magazine in the United Kingdom and a fellow with the National Review Institute and the author of numerous extraordinarily thoughtful and provocative and courageous books, including most recently The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. He is, of course, Douglas Murray. Douglas, I did want to reserve some time to talk with you, having worked through some of the very, very important and bracing insights that you have in the new book, by talking a bit about your previous one, a very, very powerful depiction of what is going on in the United Kingdom and Europe more generally. It is entitled The Strange Death of Europe, Immigration, Identity, Islam. And we've set this up by discussing a bit this phenomenon of Sharia supremacism and its willingness to make, when expedient, pacts or modus vivendi, if you will, modi vivendi, with those who are absolutely opposed to its agenda in order to achieve power. And you talked about the Ayatollah Khomeini, who did that brilliantly in Iran to secure control of Iran with the help of communists and democrats and secularists and so on, only to snuff them all when he was able to secure essentially the pinnacle of power in Tehran. Discuss, if you would, what is going on in Europe at the hands of these Islamists. I know it has not improved since you wrote your book, but give us a sort of assessment of where things stand and where you think things are headed there and what it might mean for all of us here.
Well, that's right. I mean, the strange death of Europe was centered around the 2015 migration crisis, which I simply see as being a sped-up version of something that had been going on for decades. And I trace post-war migration into Europe and then right up to that massive moment in August 2015 when Angela Merkel threw open the borders and said normal asylum procedures would no longer apply. And I reckon that the problem with the immigration discussion, which America also has so much difficulty with, is because there are basically three things that matter in migration. The first is quantity, the numbers of people coming. The second is the speed at which they come. And the third is where they come from and what they believe. And we have been terrible in the democracies at thinking about this. And we see in Europe the consequences of that. You know, Germany and Sweden added between 2-3% to their population in a single year in 2015. And that has slowed down since I wrote the book. And it has slowed down because, among other things, European leaders decided to pay a vast billions of dollars bribe to President Erdogan, the autocratic ruler in Turkey.
The theocratic ruler of Turkey, but Ed.
Exactly. And Erdogan now has a gun to Europe's head because we are bribing him to stop the boats coming from Turkey to Greece. But the boats continue to come from North Africa, and they have been heading in lower quantities than in 2015, but still heading into Italy, where Matteo Salvini, until he was miscalculated and misstepped the other week, was interior minister. And Salvini said no boats will be allowed to land with illegal migrants into Italy. But instead, the boats were directed to other countries, including Spain. And the international pressure, and specifically the European pressure on Salvini, was vast. They said that it was absolutely inhumane of him. And of course, here's the big question that is still lying there, which I posed in The Strange Death of Europe, which was, if you take the view that European leaders have been taking in recent years about migration, you get into the following problem. A poll earlier this year showed that one third of people in sub-Saharan Africa want to move. Now, those people do not want to move eastwards and you know, join one of the fledgling beautiful countries in the Middle East. They want to move to Europe. What are you going to do about that? And the European leadership's idea is we'll wait and postpone that and our successors can deal with it. And I think that this is an outrageous usurping of responsibility, because the publics do not want the fundamental alteration of their societies. They're not intolerant. Europeans are incredibly tolerant people. We've had massive migration for decades now, but they do not want to see their societies either made fundamentally different or, as is happening, utterly chaotic because we don't know who's here.
This problem is, it seems to me, almost certainly going to be upon the current generation of European leaders before they know it, if the unfolding nightmare of the meltdown of Nigeria drives perhaps the largest part of 100 million Christians out of that country. Many of them will wind up, I'm quite certain, fleeing north to Europe. And the consequences will be much as you've said. In this case, presumably, they will not be seeking to impose Sharia on Europe, which many of the previous migrants did. And you're so right to talk about what they believe as one of the key factors here. But just the sheer numbers and the speed with which they may arrive is going to be traumatic, to say the least. Hey, we're almost out of time, Douglas Murray, and I did just want to leave a few minutes for you to tell us about the drama playing out in your own country. Is this the strange death of the United Kingdom that we're witnessing in the fight over Brexit? Or what do you think is going to come of the current travails of Her Majesty's government?
Well, you know, there is so much that is similar between Britain and America these days because, and I've written this at National Review, 2016 saw two major votes in the West. And one of the things they had in common, the Brexit referendum and the election of Donald Trump, was that an elite, I don't say the elite, but an elite in both countries refused to accept the vote. And it has been, I think, a catastrophe for both of our democracies since, because you either believe in democracy or you don't. And the people who decided that they didn't when it came to those two votes have used exactly the same playbook in both countries. In both America and in my country, we have had the voters portrayed as racists, the voters portrayed as perpetrators of hate crime, the voters portrayed as stupid or narrow-minded and bigoted, the voters portrayed as having been misled by Russia, then the votes actually having been rigged by Russia, then the people who won the vote having been controlled by Russia, and on and on and on it has gone. And in the UK, we have seen, just as in the US, you've seen endless attempts to impeach, indict, delegitimize the president. So in the UK, we have seen an attempt to reverse the Brexit vote, which has been unrelenting. Currently, our now Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, insists that his one job is to take us out of the European Union, as the British people asked for 3.5 years ago, and to take us out at the end of this month. Parliament, which is dominated by people who do not agree with the electorate's vote in 2016, Parliament has been trying to do everything it can to stop that. And we are in, I mean, it is the fight of our lives as a democracy, because I believe that if the vote of the people in 2016 is ignored or reversed, then we are in exceptionally perilous waters. As I say, you either in the end, you either have a democracy or you don't.
Mm-hmm. And just crystal ball gazing, what happens over the next 3 weeks or so?
You know, the last 3 years have shown me that predicting British politics even 12 hours ahead is an absolute fool's game. We once at The Spectator ran a piece, I think last Christmas, saying the seven things, one of which has to happen this week, and an eighth thing happened that nobody had foreseen. And so I think we live in the era of the eighth thing always happening.
I think you're right, and we will have plenty of occasion to be watching this closely, as will you. I hope that you'll come back with us, Douglas Murray, as it's been too long since we've talked. I commend you once again for this book, The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. We thank you for bringing the perspectives that you do. And again, I cannot say it often enough, the courage that you exhibit in doing it. Douglas Murray, God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.